Science tells us that Hurricanes Harvey and Irma were stronger because of climate change. That view is politically controversial, even if it's based on sound science. Today's guest helps scientists communicate more effectively. She's Sunshine Menezes, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. Alongside me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to understand how stories shape public life and even public policy. One of the most consequential stories in public life today is that climate change isn't real. To help us make sense of that myth and its impact, we're joined by Dr. Sunshine Menezes, who is Executive Director of the Metcalf Institute for Marine and Environmental Reporting at the University of Rhode Island. Sunshine, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So your organization, the Metcalf Institute, is really interested in helping journalists report more effectively on science, but also helping scientists communicate more effectively with the public.
Absolutely.
Why are both those things important?
Well, for most of our history at Metcalf Institute, this is actually our 20th anniversary year, and for most of our history, we focused on journalists, so making sure that they had science training to accurately and clearly and with proper context cover environmental stories. As it turns out, because of a lot of changes in the journalism industry and social media and kind of technology in general, scientists now have the opportunity to be far more engaged in public conversations about their research and about the significance of their research. Unfortunately, scientists aren't well prepared to do that. It's just, I can say this as an oceanographer by training, this is not the communication beyond the scientific community. It's just not something we're taught how to do in graduate school. So professional development, the kind of training that Metcalf Institute does, has become really important to help scientists build skills and confidence to get out and actually talk about their work in ways that are meaningful and compelling for non-experts.
So you hinted at something there. There's been a change in the media environment. Mm-hmm. Is it that there are less traditional science reporters? Is it about the ecosystem in the newsrooms that has changed, or is there something else at play there?
Yes.
Okay.
So all of these things. Certainly the entire news ecosystem has changed pretty dramatically, but in terms of the work that we do at Metcalf, there's been a significant loss of dedicated science and environment beat reporters over the past 11 or so years. I've been executive director of Metcalf for 11 years, and over that time I've seen this really dramatic change in the number of people who are really dedicated to those beats. As a result, that means it's not as though we have fewer environment stories in the news, or fewer environment stories that should be covered in the news. And what we see then is that more political or general assignment or business journalists are covering these stories, and that is fine if that's what we have to work with, but those folks especially really need some more preparation to help them understand the science behind the story.
So what happened to this larger cadre of science and environmental reporters of 10 or 15 or 20 years ago? I mean, you're absolutely right, there are fewer of them now. What happened?
So many of them went on to different jobs. So you see a lot of these people actually doing public affairs for universities now. You see a lot of them teaching in higher ed now. And you also see some of them, thankfully, who are still doing this work, but they're maybe doing it in a different setting where either they are required to do a lot of different sorts of stories beyond
right.
science and environment, or perhaps they're working in kind of a niche publication, maybe an online publication or something, a nonprofit journalism outfit that is really having a very focused set of stories that they want to cover.
Can I just sort of jump in at that
point?
So
sure.
is What's driving that change? Is it that the newspaper industry, so we know that it's under tremendous stress and tremendous strain, but is there something about the value that we place on these particular kinds of stories? This, you know, I grew up in part of my life in Western New York, and Love Canal was a huge environmental story all over. So we just had Hurricane Harvey in Houston, where now you've got 7 Superfund sites or toxic waste sites that were flooded. These are huge environmental stories, and they literally litter the landscape. Mm-hmm. Why isn't this something that newspapers would want to spend money on?
That's a really great question. I think a lot of this comes down to budget, and a lot of newsrooms, most newsrooms, perhaps all newsrooms, are operating under smaller budgets these days and just have literally fewer reporters. And they then assign people based on the available staff that they have.
And so they can't specialize in...
Right. But you also bring up a great point, which is that I think that environment reporting in general tends to be very episodic, which is incredibly unfortunate. We see environment reporting surge, and we've seen this with climate change reporting, in response to specific events, natural disasters or human-caused disasters, whatever they may be. And then after that surge in response to an event, it kind of subsides. And this is really unfortunate because, as you say, Jim, these stories litter the landscape. They're constant, and they could be covered all the time, whether there is some specific news peg or there's just kind of the insidious nature of some of these stories that are just happening all the time.
But, you know, but if ever there were a crying need for good environmental and science journalism, it's now. I mean, we're seeing that certainly. You mentioned Superfund sites. You're going back to Love Canal, and that's an issue we can get into a little later on. There's more going on than simply climate change, mm-hmm. as big as climate change is. So you're now down to, or you deal with more people who have other responsibilities. You said general assignment people come mm-hmm. to Metcalf and learn. How do you work with them to bring sort of the skills and the toolkit that they need to convey these incredibly important stories?
Right. So a large part of what we try to do in our training programs for journalists is to help them understand the culture of scientific research. We want them to kind of experience what it is to be a scientist and recognize one of my kind of soapbox messages is that scientists and journalists, in fact, aren't that different. They're all storytellers. It's just that they tell stories under very different timelines and to different audiences. So we want to help both scientists and journalists understand this kind of storytelling kinship that they have. So part of it is this helping non-specialist reporters understand kind of the context of science, the process of scientific research, the fact that it is slow and very iterative, and giving them, these reporters, kind of a boost in their confidence so that they feel more comfortable approaching experts, finding and approaching experts on various topics, and not feeling dumb asking questions that frankly aren't dumb questions if you're not an expert, but it might be a little intimidating.
So do they have interaction with a lot of the scientists? You have a lot of great scientists down at the University of Rhode Island School of Oceanography right there in Narragansett Bay, including Bob Ballard. We have to mention Bob, who discovered the Titanic. Do these people who come in, these journalists who come in, have interaction with these actual scientists or elsewhere?
They do. So they interact with a lot of different URI scientists at the Graduate School of Oceanography, also at the College of Environment and Life Sciences, which is where we're actually based now. And we do programs all over the country. So if we do a program, say, in Seattle, where we're looking at the effects of climate change on the Pacific Northwest, then we pull scientists from that region who have expertise on the issues that are really important in that region. So we work really hard at Metcalf to identify the scientists, whether they're natural or social scientists, by the way, who have the right expertise to really pull together a big bunch of possible story ideas for these journalists who are attending. So they leave not only with a better understanding of the science and kind of the broader context, but a lot of sources that they can reach out to in their reporting.
And then they can go back to their editors very excited and say, look, I've got a great story idea, I know who to call, and that's how it works.
Exactly.
That's great, great work.
You know, and what I'm wondering is, so there's an ancient adage in politics that all politics are local, mm-hmm. right? is the coverage that you're encouraging then? So you talked about climate change in the Pacific Northwest. The stories that you might report there are going to be different than climate change in the American Southeast,
right?
I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Is that part of the imperative for journalists to tell these stories, is that they need to find that local hook?
Yes. And this, of course, this depends on the news outlet. You know, mm-hmm. if you're the New York Times, you have the luxury of writing national and international stories. But if you're a small news outlet, whether in Rhode Island or in Washington State, or in North Carolina, you need to be able to find those local sources. So when we pull these programs together, we really work hard to identify kind of bigger themes so that a person can, a reporter can say, all right, maybe we didn't have exactly the source here at this particular program that I attended who I need to talk to, but I know how to find that type of person in my local setting. Mm. And that way, again, this is all about making these stories far more interesting and contextualized for the news audience.
You know, and to sort of ping off what you said, all politics is local. In a sense, all environment is local, too. If you get a local reporter at a smaller newspaper or radio outlet or TV outlet, the readership may not read the New York Times, but they'll read their hometown product. Mm-hmm. And if it's something about sea level rise in their community, or if it's something about a toxic site or a dump or whatever in their community, it relates to them. And so that smaller, quote unquote, smaller story actually has significant impact in terms of a greater understanding. Would you agree with that, or am I just?
I certainly agree. And we've been trying, you know, when we do our programs all over the country, we generally have an application process. And we work really hard to select the most diverse group of attendees that we can. And one of the things that we look for is diversity in the medium and also in the size of the news organization, because we want to have reporters and editors or opinion writers from these smaller news outlets attending our programs just as much as we want people from really large outlets to attend them. The scope of who they can reach obviously is much smaller to local outlet, but the impact of that reporting in some cases could be more significant in terms of how the readers respond.
Do when you think, so this is a little bit about what, how the challenges of journalists reporting on science. Let's turn the camera a little bit to the challenge of getting scientists to engage with a broader public beyond the scientific community. Right. What's the principal challenge you face there?
Well, as I said before, there's this lack of preparation for scientists in their graduate programs, and that's the first challenge. Now, with younger scientists coming into the field, there is more of a kind of an innate sense of wanting to communicate more broadly. So we're not fighting that challenge as much as we were with kind of the older guard. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, they're still not getting that training. So they have to look for it themselves. There are some universities around the country that are taking strides to provide some sort of training, whether it's a course or even a program that's mm-hmm. more dedicated to science communication. And yeah. Metcalf Institute is working on this sort of thing at URI right now, actually. But it's helping these science. This is not rocket science, you know. It's a matter of giving scientists some basic communication skills and some strategies to help them understand what it is to tell an interesting story.
And I don't want to insult anybody, but is it also sort of, I don't want to say dumbing down, but is it about translating sort of science ease to a more popular audience?
Yes. So I definitely don't like to say dumbing down because I don't think that's necessary. But translation is absolutely the key. So it's about knowing who your audience is, you know? So if you're talking with a reporter, it's about reading that reporter's work and understanding kind of where they're coming from and what their knowledge base is in the work they've done before. If you're giving a public lecture, it's about understanding who are the kinds of people that are going to come to that lecture. Really basic stuff about communicating, you know.
So let me take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program can be heard 3 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, 124. The show is produced each week by a really talented team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I'm the executive director of the Pell Center, a public policy and international relations think tank on the campus of Selvyn Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. I'm tweeting at JM Lutis. My co-host is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of more than a dozen books. He's G. Wayne Miller, and he tweets at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is executive director of the Metcalf Center for Marine and Environmental Reporting at the University of Rhode Island. Dr. Sunshine Menezes is also the editor of the book Communicating on Climate Change, an essential resource for journalists, scientists, and educators. And you can follow her work on Twitter at MetcalfURI. So Sunshine, I'm thinking about a couple of scientists that have weighed into issues like, I think it's Thomas Mann.
Michael Mann,
weighed in on the link between climate change and Harvey in a Facebook post that went viral. Mm-hmm. That's not without some peril in terms of the public reaction that engenders. Are universities prepared for, if scientists are more engaged on issues, they're also going to attract more criticism? Are universities prepared for the reaction that those types of posts are going to elicit?
That's a great question, and in general, I'd have to say no. In some cases, there are universities whose public affairs staff or public information staff are really engaging with their researchers across the university to prepare them for this sort of thing. Michael Mann doesn't need that kind of preparation because he's really an expert at this point in terms of science communication. But he's gotten a lot of pushback, like a lot of other climate scientists have, from people who deny that human-caused climate change is happening. I think that a lot of universities have not really even started to address how they can help their researchers engage in the pushback. You know, there's support for getting out there and talking about science, but not as much for how do you deal with the drama and trauma that might cause for a person.
Yeah.
Why that reluctance? Is that just academia in general being sort of conservative? I mean, it seems to me now is, again, the time when people need to be speaking up. Respected
yeah.
experts who know what they're talking about and can influence public policy.
I agree with you. I think it is the time. I also agree that there is just some kind of traditional conservative ideas in academia about the role of a scientist in the public sphere, and also among scientists. So traditionally, scientists were expected to do their work and publish their results and get their grants, period. And now, there are growing expectations about the role of a scientist in the public sphere, and we're all kind of figuring this out as we go along. There aren't real rules for most academic institutions about how a researcher can or a faculty member can talk. In fact, that's one of the nice things about academia. There aren't many rules on faculty members. They're free to go out and talk about anything they want in general. But it is the time for, I would argue, for people who have expertise to share that expertise. And not just to say, I am an expert and I know things and I want to tell you things, but also to interact with public audiences in a much more engaging way, which is to say, hello, community, where I'm doing my research, tell me how you are interested in the work that I'm doing and how you can inform it and how I can learn from you and how we can work together.
I think we saw sort of the turning of the tide there, perhaps, in the marches for science across the nation. I know the ones that I read about, I covered one here in Rhode Island, there were scientists who, even a year ago, never would have stood on a State House front lawn or in front of wherever they were, and talked about these issues, and they did it. And I think that was transformational. You mentioned time. When is the time to do it? The head of the EPA just recently said that it would be insensitive, and that was his word, insensitive to talk about climate change in the wake of Irma and Harvey. How do you react to that?
I think it's outrageous. I think that's an absurd argument. And it also, I find it outrageous that the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency would say something like that, specifically him. This is at a very important time to talk about climate change. I think that the press in general did a really great job in talking about, or at least starting to talk about, climate change in the context of Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma. Television, not so much. But television news is a much more challenging situation because they have less time. But in the print,
although they spent a lot of time with anchors, you know, standing there in the wind and the rain, just agreed, looking wet.
Agreed.
It was great TV. I mean,
it is great TV. Yeah, right. Yeah,
I thought it was great TV.
Right. They could do, when it comes to a 24/7 news channel like CNN, they have no excuse for not talking about climate change a lot more. You know, a local news channel perhaps doesn't have that kind of leeway. I'll cut them a little bit of slack, the local news channels.
But is there even, there's something else too, because they oftentimes, in the interest of seeming balanced, will give, I don't know if credibility is the right word, but they'll give airtime to people that the science just doesn't, I mean, there's always questions in science. That's part of the essence of science, right?
Right.
But around climate change, there's really not a lot of debate in terms of what the mechanisms are that are causing it. And so our to the extent that you give countenance to anybody who sort of questions that basic science, aren't you doing the public a grave disservice?
Yes. And so that's called false balance in this field, when you provide two voices, one saying one side of things and the other providing the other side of things, when in fact one of those sides is represented by 99% of scientists and the other side is represented by 1% of scientists. So there's clearly a false balance there.
Yeah.
I actually think that there's far less of that happening these days than there used to be. Certainly than 10 years ago, false balance with regard to climate change was a big problem, and that's not as big a problem now. On television news, it is still more of a problem.
Depending on what channel or network you're
especially
listening
depending
to.
On the channel or network that you're listening to, absolutely.
So how does the public and how do journalists sort of attack that false balance? Because I agree, you know, in 1492, you might want to have balance, is the earth round or not? Columbus says yeah, and the rest of us say no. Okay, it's not 1492. how do you address that? You know, it gets tied into this whole fake news thing, and we talk about that often on this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, at some point you just get sick of it. It's like, come on.
Why
we don't need balance on something that 99% of respected scientists agree on.
Right, and I think, you know, this has something to do with journalism education. Traditionally, you are supposed to balance your sources. But I think that the journalism industry really needs to evolve and evolve in its education. And not to throw educators under the bus here, because many journalism educators have evolved in that regard. But it is just a longstanding tradition, you know better than I, in the field. So it's improving. We as news consumers need to hold our journalists' feet to the fire and call them out, I think, when there's a story that offers false balance, and write letters to the editor or call the channel or whatever and say.
And I think you're absolutely right. That whole syndrome, if that's the right word, it really is subsiding. I happen to sit next to, and I'm a good friend of, the environmental writer for the Providence Journal, Alex Kuffner, who is an extraordinary reporter. He would not even think of, like, let's call up a climate doubter when I'm writing about sea level rise. It just wouldn't even occur to him at this point. So that's a sign of progress. And he's not alone, by the way, in that shift.
I agree. I'm very proud to say that Alex is a Metcalf Institute alum.
Oh, well,
and
there we go.
We have
right?
We have many, many alumni all over the country, and in fact, all over the world, who are not using false balance, who are, you know, bringing these more nuanced conversations
so there's
to
a
their
change.
Reporting.
You're part of that change?
Absolutely.
I wonder if you could sort of even open this aperture a little bit more. I spend a lot of time, because of the work that I do, thinking about the country's historic literacy and civic literacy. Mm-hmm. How does the country do in terms of scientific literacy? Is the public able to parse these issues with the level of sophistication that citizens in a republic maybe we should expect them to?
Yeah, this is such a complicated topic. I guess at the simplest level, I would say no. I would love to see far greater scientific literacy in the U.S. But it really varies by topic. And also, people tend to be really interested in science that they can be enthusiastic about, you know? So there are some issues like climate change. I don't mean to keep going back there, but it's such a case study.
Yeah.
There are some issues that can be really hard to grasp in their totality, you know, that can feel very overwhelming. If you are just, you know, a person living their life who is not a scientist and not a journalist and just going through your daily life and you keep seeing stories about climate change and you might think, how can I do anything about this? So there is the challenge of for scientists and for journalists of pushing past that fatigue and helping people get information that they need to make decisions about how they choose to act in response to these various environmental problems.
I want to use the word balance again. I'll be very quick here because I realize the clock is running down. But climate change is such an enormous subject, and it dominates a lot of our scientific writing and conversations. But there are a lot of other environmental issues that are very critical in terms of pollution, and you were talking about toxic waste, in terms of the poisons that we throw in our lawn so our grass can get a little greener and we don't have a stupid little weed, mm-hmm. which gets into the water, which gets into people, and so forth and so on. What do you say to journalists in terms of like getting to those as well as the climate change, given that they don't have unlimited resources?
In about 30 seconds.
We always do this. <I'm sorry. laughs> We apologize.
Well, I think that once a journalist feels better prepared to go talk to a scientist, any scientist, that means that the world is their oyster. They can translate that confidence to covering any story. And so they need to just follow their nose. Reporters know where there's a good story. And if they don't have a nose for a good environmental story, all they need to do is call up their local researchers and start asking around, is there something I'm not covering that I should be? And they'll get an earful.
We're going to have to leave it there. Sunshine Menezes, the book is Communicating on Climate Change. We want to thank you, too, for joining us for this edition of Storing the Public Square. If you want to learn more about our work, please visit us at pellcenter.org, or you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Storing the Public Square.